This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of NPR's very best arts and culture stories. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for the Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, editor of NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
You can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
a look at a new film about the life and struggles of Charles Darwin.
We remember the great jazz guitarist Django Reinhardt.
And a profile of the godfather of punk, Iggy Pop. But first,
the Sundance Film Festival kicked off this weekend, and it could not have come at a worse time for independent film. It seems harder than ever to get small films made, and harder still to get them into theaters. Most major studios have closed their indie divisions, and the recession has all but dried up financing for these films. The luckiest ones that do make it often debut at Sundance. NPR's Madeline Brand spoke with John Cooper, the new director of the Sundance Film Festival, and she asked him if it's really that bad out there for indie filmmakers.
You think it was, but actually not. I think it's actually a very optimistic time for independent film. We did go through, you know, not without our bumps and bruises right now. But if you look at our submission numbers this year, those are the people that, you know, submitted films that weren't made under the studio system. It was actually the same amount of films this year and even more, especially in the shorts categories. So it's not a bad time for creativity. It's just a bad time for all the ways you connect with an audience.
In other words, getting them seen.
Right. And those old traditional methods of getting films seen are changing daily.
What are the options then for independent filmmakers? Because as we've said, many film studios have shut down their independent divisions and there's not a lot of financing out there during this recession. So what are their options?
Yeah, that's true. Financing is difficult. What a lot of filmmakers are doing are going lower budget. They're using technology in their favor in the way they're going to put out their films.
So distributing online, that kind of thing?
Yep, online, marketing online in particular. What kind of, I think, killed a lot of the independent industry, as we call it, was really that marketing dollars and how much it takes to reach an audience. And that's all, it's all up for grabs right now. It's all changing rapidly. We have many films at our festival that are actually using the festival platform as a leaping off point to actually launch their films into the marketplace. They're not waiting to be picked up and then many months later make it into theaters. A lot of them are just jumping right into the direct-to-audience technology platforms.
You're a brand new director of the Sundance Film Festival, the first new one in 20 years. How are you going to change it?
Yeah, that's sort of true and it sort of isn't. I've actually worked for the film festival for 20 years.
Oh, okay.
So I like to say, you know, whatever was wrong with the festival, I'm both I'm also might be the blame. So I went back to the drawing board a little bit and I wanted to talk to our stakeholders, and that's the fans that come to the festival. And I also listened a lot. I listened a lot to the filmmakers, the filmmaking community. We added this new section called Next, which is for no and low budget filmmaking. That was new. We changed our opening night up to make it a little less formal. And we launched right into our competition last night, which was very exciting. And then we're doing a new program, which is Sundance Film Festival USA, where we're taking 8 films that are premiering at the festival and taking out to 8 cities across America. That was designed to plant a stake in the ground and a place to really talk about the notion of film in our culture and what it means to our society to have art in general in our society. It's something that we're grossly neglecting in our national dialogue.
You know, I think the major studios could learn a thing or two from this guy.
It sounds like it, based on the actual decision to listen to what people want to see.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
And I should also mention, while we're on the topic of Sundance, that at Monkey See, we have a reviewer, Ella Taylor, who has been out at Sundance. She's been doing some blogging for us, and she has talked about a bunch of the different movies that she's seen out there. She talked about The Runaways, which is the Joan Jett biopic. She talked about a half-hour short film from Spike Jones and some other things that she's been following out there. So you can find that on the blog, and we'll make sure that we have a link to all of her stuff from Sundance.
And we've got another art house movie to discuss.
Absolutely. Creation is a drama about Charles Darwin and his struggle to develop his Origin of Species. Darwin is played by Paul Bettany, probably best known for his role in A Beautiful Mind. As critic Bob Mondello explains, Creation is a movie about Darwin's struggle with religion, and it's a movie that struggled in the U.S. to find a distributor.
a movie about the evolution of the theory of evolution, and one that hopes to find an audience in the U.S. If Creation had been made in Hollywood, there'd be much tiptoeing around the subject of religion, but it's from Britain, and it makes the science-faith debate central, right from the start, when Charles Darwin explains to his 10-year-old daughter Annie why he's been stalling for years on his treatise on the origin of species.
What are you so scared of?
Suppose the whole world stopped believing that God had any sort of plan for us. Nothing mattered, not love, not trust, not faith, not honor. Only brute survival. Apart from anything else, it would break your mother's heart.
And therein lies the film. Deeply religious Emma Darwin is hardly anti-science. She kind of gets a kick out of her husband's habit of writing every gurgle down as their 10 children go through infancy. But she's also concerned about his soul and where his research may be taking him.
Charles, do you not care that you may never pass through the gates of heaven and that you and I may be separated for all eternity?
Well, of course I care. Of course I do. What do you think has kept me in limbo all these years? I'm a scientist, and I dare not study for the fear of seeing more clearly what is already as plain as day to me.
Faith versus science neatly wrapped up as a Darwinian domestic dispute. Director John Amiel, working from a book by Darwin's great-great-grandson, animates this idea with sharp performances by real-life spouses Paul Bettany and Jennifer Connelly, and also with arresting visuals as the biologist bonds with a captive orangutan and as he and his daughter are subjected to the ghastly medical quackery of hydrotherapy. Purists might argue about some Victorian spirit world story elements involving Annie, but if the film takes some liberties, they generally make sense dramatically, picturing Darwin's voyages not when they happened, for instance, but when he tells his kids bedtime stories about them, or using time-lapse photography to illustrate scientific leaps he's on the verge of making. In fact, given its subject matter, Creation arguably should be bolder and more shocking if it wants to survive among the fittest at the multiplex. Audiences may not regard a straightforward biopic as a natural selection, but Creation has ample grace on its side, and as many have noted, if you're not at least a little shocked by the audacity of what Darwin did, chances are you don't understand it. I'm Bob Mandela.
Dolan Perkins Valdez is a writer who has taken on a rather shocking topic of her own in her new novel, Wench. It's not set at a Renaissance fair. It's about something much more painful, the relationship between slave owners and the slaves who were their lovers and often the mother of their children. The book is set on a resort in Ohio where Southern slave owners vacationed with their slave mistresses. The story focuses on four of these women. Dolan Perkins Valdez spoke with Lynn Neary about her book.
I want to ask you first to set the scene, because this is a really interesting place that I never understood could have existed. It's a resort in the North, but Southern slave owners would vacation there with their mistresses. And it was a real place, right?
Right.
Tell me more about it.
Well, one of the things that allowed them to go there were the advances in transportation at the time. So they would ride the steamship up the Mississippi River and then veer off onto the Ohio River. And when they got off the ship, they could take the train up to Xenia, Ohio. And that was a new railroad. It was the Little Miami Railroad. I think when Elias Drake opened the resort, he did not expect that it would become popular among slaveholders and these women. But that was sort of an unintended effect just based on the fact that they were able to get there.
How did you first hear about this resort?
I first heard about it while reading a biography of W.E.B. Du Bois by David Levering Lewis called Biography of a Race. And it was in the section of the book where he talks about the time that Du Bois taught at Wilberforce University. And he said he was talking about the origins of Wilberforce University, and he said that it may have been, and I'm paraphrasing here, the most unusual resort hotel in America because it was popular among slaveholders and their enslaved mistresses. And I said, what? And I couldn't believe it. I had never heard of this before. And then he moved on to something else. And so it was sort of just one of those little historical footnotes that I tried to take and imagine what that place would have been like.
And was it hard for you to just even delve into this history, some of the things that you learned? Maybe there were things you hadn't known before.
Delving into the history was actually most fascinating for me. Finding out, for example, that many of the early students at Wilberforce University were the children of Southern planters, And I think that the historical research of it was really actually more fascinating than anything else because I didn't know any of this.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
We are going to move on to some music. This past weekend marked the centennial birthday of a musical genius. That word gets thrown around a lot, but when it comes to music, Django Reinhardt certainly deserves that mantle. With no formal training, the guitarist created a new style of music in the 1930s and 40s, which came to be dubbed Gypsy Jazz. He's one of the very few European musicians to ever exert a serious influence on the American art form of jazz. NPR's Tom Cole has an appreciation.
People, even those who knew him, speak of Django Reinhardt with a kind of awe, as almost some superhuman being consumed with music.
He was the first great European jazz musician. Really, music was it. That was him. He and music were synonymous.
Talking to his bass player, Emmanuel Sautier, he leaned forward and just really wanted me to understand this. He said, Django was music made into a man.
Pianist John Lewis and biographer Michael Dregney talking about a musician who overcame enormous obstacles to become one of the most influential and popular performers of his day. Django was born outside the town of Ybergy, Belgium, in a wooden trailer to a family of Roma, or gypsies as they're commonly called, nomads distrusted and persecuted wherever they went. But that's not the half of it. When he was 18, after establishing himself as a virtuoso of both guitar and banjo in the Paris clubs, Reinhardt suffered a terrible accident. Michael Dregney has written two books about Django and the music he created.
He was playing banjo in a dance hall in Paris. He returned to his caravan late in the night. His young wife was making flowers out of celluloid that she would sell at cemeteries. And Django lit a candle, and this candle fell onto the floor, and it hit these celluloid flowers, which burst into flames, and the whole caravan went up. His whole right side of his body was burned. His left hand, his fretting hand, was horribly burned in this fire.
Burned, saving his pregnant wife. Django spent more than a year in and out of hospitals. No one thought he would play again. But the name Django means "I awake" in the Romani language, and that he did. Through hours of painful practice, he came up with a new way of playing that allowed him to generate flurries of notes with those two fingers and his lightning-quick right hand. Django Reinhardt and the Quintet of the Hot Club of France, with Stephane Grappelli playing violin, became the toast of Paris. Then World War II broke out. More than 1 million Roma were exterminated, along with 5 times that many Jews. Yet Django and his band prospered. Again, author Michael Dregney.
The Germans used Paris basically as their rest and relaxation center. When the soldiers came, they wanted wine and women and song, and to many of them, jazz was the popular music, and Django was the most famous jazz musician in Paris. And it was really a golden age of swing with these gypsies living kind of this grand irony.
In 1940, with the Marseillaise banned by the Germans, Django wrote a new anthem that struck a chord in France. Nuages, or clouds, became Django's best-known composition, a bittersweet ode to occupied France. The liberation brought many American jazz musicians to Paris. One of them was the late John Lewis. In a 2000 NPR interview, he remembered having to drag Django away from a Dizzy Gillespie show so the guitarist could make his own gig.
Wanted to play less American music more than anybody else. Putting my own people. This man was literally playing himself into greatness. He said, "You're going to pay attention to me."
That desire to play jazz kept pushing Django. He mastered hot jazz, swing, and bebop. By the end of his life, he was experimenting with electric guitar. He's one of the few musicians to create an entire genre in his likeness. Django Reinhardt died on a warm spring day in 1953. After a morning spent engaged in one of his favorite pastimes, fishing, Django went to a cafe where he collapsed from a stroke. He was just 43 years old. Tom Cole, NPR News.
I just want to say that Tom Cole, the guy who did this piece, is a arts editor here at National Public Radio who's been here forever and ever and ever. He's completely, he's one of the most respected arts editors in the building. And one of the great fun perks of living in Washington, D.C. is that Tom has a radio show on another public radio station, a Pacifica station, on Sunday morning called The G-String, and all it is guitar jazz. And it's really one of the highlights of living here is listening to Tom's radio show on Sunday morning. That's Patti Smith's first studio recording, a single she made in 1974 in Jimi Hendrix's studio, Electric Lady. Patti Smith is an electric lady herself. Her memoir is called Just Kids. It's about her childhood in New Jersey, moving to New York in 1967, and her evolution into one of the most definitive voices of her generation as a poet, songwriter, and performer. Patti Smith recently spoke to Terry Gross on Fresh Air about the origins of one of her first songs.
Now, you say in your book that your first song started as a poem, Fire of Unknown Origin.
Yes.
So I'd like you, if you wouldn't mind, to recite the poem and tell us how that became a song. And then we'll hear the recording of the song.
I wrote it at the Chelsea Hotel, and it was just a little song. Or a little poem, Fire of Unknown Origin took my baby away. A fire of unknown origin took my baby away. It took me up. Just how does it go? It took, I'm sorry. A fire of unknown origin took my baby away. A fire of unknown origin took my baby away. It took me up and off the highway. Into a fire thick and gray. Death comes sweeping down the hallway like a lady's dress. Death comes riding up the highway in its Sunday best. Death comes riding, death comes creeping, death comes. There must be something that remains. Death, it made me sick and crazy because that fire, it took my baby away. Essentially, it's just a little poem. But I was listening to a lot of early blues and these really old R&B songs like Bacon Fat and just early blues songs. And I think it just came out. You know, it's an easy, with my accent, especially my thick South Jersey accent back then, I had such a drawl in my talking. It just seemed to naturally go into from a fire of unknown origin to a fire of unknown origin. And that's sort of how it happened.
Okay, so why don't we hear the recording that you made of it? And this is a bonus track from the reissue of your 1979 album, Wave.
Five unknown origin took my brain.
There's more Patti Smith on our website, npr.org. And from the godmother of punk to the godfather of punk. As you might have heard last week, NPR is asking, what makes a voice great? In a year-long series called 50 Great Voices. Some of the voices we will profile are beautiful, some soulful. And some voices, as NPR's Robert Smith says about this week's entry, just slap you across the face. The voice he's talking about, Iggy Pop.
Okay, punk rock haters, put your earplugs in now. Iggy and the Stooges, 1973, sounds as nasty and as raw as it did almost four decades ago. I'm a sleepwalking cheetah with a hat full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of a nuclear A-bomb. I know you haters didn't actually put in your earplugs and you're probably writing complaint letters right now. Just know this, Iggy Pop still doesn't care what you think.
After how many years I've been doing this, I've never been willing to either bait myself or justify myself. I don't have to.
See, here's the thing. Up until the era of Iggy Pop and the Stooges, a great voice was usually one that charmed the audience, made the girls swoon or the men jealous. Iggy proved that a voice could be a weapon. So where did Iggy learn this technique? Easy. Frank Sinatra.
I'll never forget riding in the back of my parents' Cadillac, and my father was singing along, fairy tales can come true, it can happen to you, if you're young at heart. And I thought, gee, I'd like to do that, you know.
It wasn't the tone, necessarily, that he wanted to imitate. It was the distinctiveness of the voice.
People tend to jump on the bandwagon, and the bandwagon at that time was like dumb. Members of the British yob classes growing their hair and butchering the American blues, or quasi-classical adaptations in prog rock. Bleah.
So were you sitting around going, I don't want to sound like that, I don't want to sound like that, I don't want to sound like that?
Yes, exactly. It was very important what not to do. It has to get up off the couch, walk around, and be original.
When the Stooges released their first album in 1969, they stripped away rock to the bare essentials. A couple of notes, a few chords, good to go. No fun, my babe. No fun. Iggy sang about suburban teenage hell, boredom, and alienation. No fun to hang around. Feeling that same old way. Iggy didn't follow that punk rock road, though. He got lost. Then he followed David Bowie to Berlin for the nightclubbing and Lust for Life eras. He dabbled in ska, new wave, finally recorded that album of standards he always wanted to do. But the spirit of the original Iggy endures. In fact, he's back on tour this summer. Still bares his chest, stage dives. At 62 years old, the voice is stronger than ever. But it is missing something.
The part you can't get is the attitude. I've got the same kid in me. But when he was ignorant, he was more compellingly dangerous vocally. And I can't quite get to that place.
So he'll have to settle for another kind of place. Iggy Pop and the Stooges will be inducted this year into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Bring on the bottles. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
50 Great Voices will continue all year, and you'll be able to follow the entire thing at our website, npr.org. That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.